Fearscape Media Network. Exploring the unknown. One podcast at a time.
Hey everyone, Josh here from Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. Have you been to our website, fearscapepodcast.com? There you can check out our store with all of our awesome t-shirts, check out guests that have been on the show, listen to the podcast directly on the website, even donate and help us bring you awesome content. Please consider supporting us. fearscapepodcast.com.
Hey everybody, Stefan here. This episode is sponsored by the great folks over at Box Mountain. Box Mountain is a subscription box service that has my favorite sub box yet, the Cryptid Crate. You see, Josh got one of these for his birthday, and I was super jealous because it was packed full of merchandise pertaining to cryptids. The box he received first was all about the Flatwoods Monster, which of course is one of our favorites, and it had a t-shirt, a book, a patch, mug, and some awesome stickers. So I checked out the price to get one for myself, and let me tell you, it is well worth the value. These make excellent gifts for yourself or even friends that are cryptid lovers as well. Now, if you use the coupon code Fearscape, you will get 25% off the first month for any new subscription or 10% off individual purchases. So go ahead and head on over to fearscapepodcast.com/cryptidcrate now and get yourself one today.
Hello. I'm so glad you could join us. I hope you brought your blanket to hide under. The spooky crew is going to discuss things and events from other realms. Ghosts, cryptids, aliens. Be sure to hold your blanket extra tight as the boys take you deep into the Fearscape.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another fantastic episode of Fearscape Paranormal Podcast here on the Fearscape Media Network. I am your host, Stefan Gearhart, and I am joined, as always, by the man that has been referred to as sweeter than sugar, but crusty like a booger, my co-host, Mr. Josh Rutledge. What up, man?
Hey, man. I don't know how to take that introduction. I like the idea of being sweeter than sugar, but I don't know if I want to be crusty like a bug.
I was trying to get a little Muhammad Ali on you, man. Like, you know.
Well, I feel like for the second part, I'm like that monk guy from the Golden Child that, like, you know, picks his nose and, like, he wipes it on his jacket. And man. Eddie Murphy's like, "You're just gonna wipe that there, huh?" It's like, yep. Frozen. You're gonna scratch yourself later.
You're gonna cut yourself. We have brought up Golden Child many times on this
many
show.
Times. More it's a than, great movie.
It is fantastic. Movie. But I didn't want to say salty because I didn't want to imply that, you know, you've been eaten. You know, like, I'd rather go with crusty.
Okay. I mean, salty is like, right, it implies that you're, I don't know, rude, I guess.
Right. Well, crusty. So my sister uses salty and crusty all the time. She's like, "Ooh, don't get crusty, don't get salty." They mean two different things, but they're very similar. They're very similar. That's why you could be sweet.
Maybe
like
we
sugar.
Need a. So are we going to work in an Urban Dictionary segment into the show? I mean, where are we going?
Yes.
With this?
Well, the Fearscape Urban Dictionary.
Dictionary.
We just like words that we and our guests have made up over the years. But anyways, yeah, exactly. I want to thank everyone for joining us. I had a really great time last week with Kyle Cadell. I just wanted to give him another shout out. Make sure you get out to that museum in Somerset there. But we have a really cool guest tonight as well. We have Shane Hurd, who is a MUFON field investigator, which of course is the Mutual UFO Network, out of my new hometown, Phoenix, Arizona. Not only is he a MUFON field investigator, but he's also an author. He's recently, this past year, written and published a book called The Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, A Beginner's Guide to Researching UFOs. It is available on Amazon. I'm sure we'll be talking about it. But yeah, this guy is pretty cool. You reached out to him. We've been trying to find a MUFON investigator to talk to so we can talk about MUFON and just what all goes into that. And Shane, so graciously, decided to come on board, so we're gonna be talking to him after the break. But of course, before we get to that, Joshy Poo, we gotta get to our segments. And for those tuning in, we got a brand new segment tonight that we're gonna be airing, which we'll, when we get to it, we'll let you know. But first, as always, we have the psychic word of the week.
And now the psychic word of the week.
All right. And I noticed last week, apparently I did the for psychic word of the week, I announced it like the guy from the old guy from Price is Right. So it was like the psychic word of the week. That's right. The Encyclopedic Psychic Dictionary from June G. Blitzer, PhD. Come on down. Something like that. So I just tried to emulate it. So you guys know we do. We have the Encyclopedic Psychic Dictionary from my honey bear, Juju Blitzer. Rest in peace, honey buns. But we flipped through the book. I asked Josh this time to tell me when to stop. I had the book under the table. We landed on page 105, which is in the letter C. And the phrase that grabbed my attention first was changing woman. And no, this is not at Walmart. With new socks and shirts and things like that. That's not what this means. It's actually a Navajo Native American term. It says respected as a holy person. So immediately that's the first thing, is that a changing woman is respected as a holy person. They have the psychic ability to summon etheric world angels in charge of nature to help the people when in need of rain, wind, and other natural events necessary for their existence. So it almost sounds like I had it in my head and I can't think of it now, like a weather shaman almost, you know.
Very elemental in what they are doing. So
it's interesting to see the word angel, you know, mixed in. I'm like, I know that that's more of a Christian type word. Leads me to believe that it's that kind of mixed, you know, maybe that, you know, because the Spanish came in and maybe added some of their beliefs to the Navajo.
Or something that I've been really thinking a lot about lately is that angel really is just an intermediary between us, the physical, and God, the universe, God, the etheric, right?
Yeah.
And so angel doesn't necessarily have to be like the Bible's description of an angel. It could be anything that is that messenger that is carrying the message or carrying the magic or carrying the whatever from whomever you're asking for.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because growing up Catholic, it's very similar along those lines with saints and priests and things like that. It's like you always go through them instead of going to God. And it's almost as if God ain't got time for little things like that. So he leaves it up to his press secretary and other people like that.
Yeah, you know, when I say God, I don't necessarily mean God as a being.
Oh, I know. I just mean like growing up Catholic, I get that. It's that intermediary that kind of exists in between, because the big one is possibly too big, and so sometimes we need smaller versions to feel not overwhelmed, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
So maybe the use of angel here is not so much from the Christian understanding of angel, but more of that, you know, adaptation, if you will.
Yeah, it almost sounds like an elemental spirit, like we were, you know, alluding to in the very, very beginning. But it's interesting because changing woman immediately to me, I thought was going to be a shapeshifter. But no, it's just someone who is able to help change the weather patterns. So very, very interesting. Thank you, June G. Bletzer, for your guidance. So let's go ahead and get out of that and move into spooky news, because we've got some potentially weird, not weird, but like kind of scary news. Like, this is weird stuff, man. And it's gonna hamper everyone in the UFO field. So
yeah,
let's move into spooky
news. It's gonna impact a lot.
So this comes from CNN Business. The headline here reads that drone delivery one step closer to reality with new FAA rules. Now, you know, a lot of this Amazon and stuff like that, they're really trying to push being able to make deliveries through drones. Basically, so they don't have to pay people. What the article here says, Amazon, Google's parent Alphabet, and UPS all hope to one day deliver large amounts of goods by drone. Now, new U.S. government rules clear some hurdles to making that dream a reality. The FAA finalized new rules for small, unmanned drones on Monday that could pave the way for expanded commercial uses of the vehicles, including delivery surfaces. For the very first time, the FAA will allow small commercial drones to fly short distances over people and at night without a waiver. Small drones will also be permitted to fly over moving vehicles under limited conditions. In a change from a previous proposed draft of the rules, drone operators must also have their remote pilot certificates on their persons and ready to be displayed if challenged by authorities. The rules apply to drone operators who use their unmanned aircraft for work or business under the FAA's Part 107 regulations. As many as 1.7 million drones right now have been registered with the FAA, as well as more than 203,000 drone pilots, the agency said. And the new rules will make way for further integration of drones into our airspace by addressing safety and security concerns. They get us closer to the day when we will routinely see drone operations such as the delivery of packages, said FAA Administrator Steve Dixon. And I could continue on, but essentially it's kind of frightening, to be honest with you, because now we're going to have so many UFO sightings that are going to be drones.
Well, so two things that come to mind, and first of all is these things aren't small. Like, I don't know if you've seen pictures of these commercial size drones.
Right, it reminds me of the size. Yeah, it reminds me of that news story in Nebraska that we had to ask Santosh about those giant.
Right.
Freaking drones.
I mean, it's they're like the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, like the old style, like this, you know, 60s and 70s style. But I mean, it's about that high and about that size. And then the second thing is and this is where I hope, because the FAA is putting this into place, and you have to have these things in place, like you have to have your license, you have to be registered. What I'm hoping is like the two apps that I use to validate what I'm seeing in the sky, like to rule things out. I'm hoping that drones will show up as registered in the area of vehicles.
Yeah. What I really want is something that records all that to be able to go back. So, like, for example, to look at a UAP sighting and we could go back and go, oh, look, here's where they were. That was a drone delivering a package. And this whole thing is set so that it could be like dominoes back in the day, so they can get you a package in 30 minutes or less. I'm like, I don't need an adult coloring book in 30 minutes or less. Like, I can get it in a couple days. Like, it's fine.
But, you know, I mean, like, we had a I've been ordering stuff to make my office more sound proof so that I can move out of the area that I'm doing the pod in now and back into my office. And so the other day, like, I went out to leave to go to the store, and like I opened the garage door, and there was like 10 boxes sitting by my garage door, and I'm like, holy crap. But I mean, the one thing that I will say about Amazon is that they're not very efficient. So like, they could have three different trucks come and deliver three different packages to my house on the same day.
Yeah, I used to do that Amazon delivery, because they just let anybody and their mother do it. It's, you know, it's a a 1099.
But I mean,
job.
That's
and I would get there, and there's like, I'd run into another guy who's delivering a package, and we're like, why didn't we just get both of these?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you can imagine then that how many different drones might be flying back and forth, especially if a drone can only carry, you know, like a couple boxes at a time, and there's probably a weight limit on it. So I'm more worried about anything with all this that, like, I'm gonna have a crash on my house in the middle of the night where two drones collide in with one another. So, I mean, could you imagine if you're, like, you know, an air traffic controller and the stress that you have now for controlling how many planes are in the air, you add into the mix 2 million drones? I mean, that's
The news story does say, it says, under the new FAA rules, small drones will now be equipped with anti-collision lights and other technology to help remotely identify both the aircraft and their operators. And an interesting thing is that drone pilots usually have to undergo an in-person training test every 2 years. They will no longer have to do that because now they can just do it online.
Oh, but I mean, yeah. I know they're going to have lights on them and stuff. And I mean, I understand that, but it's still the tracking of all the different things in the air is just going to be crazy ridiculous. The amount of, like I said, it's already stressful for those folks with just the airplanes and helicopters that are in the air. So
yeah, I know.
It's just, yeah.
I'm with you. It just seems crazy. I mean, like I said, it's just like, and you know, Amazon's also putting up satellites, you know, to compete with Elon Musk for the Wi-Fi
Starlink
thing.
And stuff.
Like,
yeah.
God, I mean, we're just going to be overwhelmed with lights in the sky. And I don't know. The only thing I hope is that so many people are going to start seeing stuff that maybe they'll start getting interested. You know?
Yeah, well,
it could be a gateway drug.
I mean, I suspect that, the guy we're going to talk to here in a little bit, his job is going to get a lot more difficult to validate if things were a drone versus an actual, UFO. So,
yeah. Well, all right. Well, I want to move into our new brand new segment. Instead of going to UAP sighting of the week, which I kind of want to save the end because neither of us have creepy catch up this week. So I want to save the UAP, the sighting of the week, since we got a move on guy. We've got a brand new segment that we've been talking about for a while that we've been wanting to do. And that is introducing our listeners every week to a brand new cryptid of the week. Both of us have like a cryptid monster book, and we've just so many that we haven't heard of. Some small town ones and things like that. So buckle your seatbelt and get ready for Cryptid of the Week.
Hi, y'all. It's the Jersey Devil. Hope y'all are ready to meet some of my friends.
Cryptid of the Week.
All right, Josh, Cryptid of the Week. What do we got for our very first Cryptid of the Week? Who are we looking at?
Well, so first of all, I want to give a shout out to the theologian because he sent me this book for Christmas, and it is just full of a lot of great information about cryptids. So a shout out to the theologian for looking out for me and for the show.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the I'm gonna butcher this. Ahool. A H O O L.
Well, yeah,
Ahoolahan. First reported in 1925 in Java, Indonesia. And the cryptid type is aerial bat-like. And then and this book gives it a reality rating, which is 3 stars. And it says some evidence supports the possibility of the cryptid being real. So,
interesting. So says, more than just one guy saying they seen it.
Right, exactly. So it says Dr. Ernest Bartels in the natural is the naturalist who discovered this bat-like cryptid in 1925. After hearing it screech, "Ahool, ahool, ahool," he named it for the strange vocalization. While naturalist Dr. Bartels is credited with spotting the black and gray ahool in Indonesia, he is not the only person to make such a claim. In August of 2015, student Pedro Rogue reported seeing a similar creature in Almada, Portugal, which is on the Tagus River. I and another friend heard a noise above, Pedro told the Cryptozoology News. It looked like a large flying animal, perhaps a giant bat. With a 10-foot wingspan and spearing teeth, the ahool is thought to be a fish eater, and its proximity to a river supports that theory. Pedro and his friends tracked the animal for a few seconds before it disappeared into the thick brush.
Mm-mm, y'all get out. That's Dracula.
I mean, there's a lot more information here about the Ohul, and I won't go into great detail. If you're interested, you know, look it up. But interesting here that we've got 1925, a giant bat. Interesting how related this could be to Mothman sightings.
Thought about that a little bit.
You know, because a bat is still a mammal type animal. It's, you know, it still has fur on its body, and then the wings. Mothman is described as kind of being bird-like with fur, feathers on its body, and wings. So it's interesting. Could these two creatures really be the same? And again, like we've talked about before, how different areas attribute them to different things. If you live in an area that has a lot of bats, you might attribute it to being a giant bat. Right. You know? So.
Well, what's interesting is that they apparently named this cryptid like you would name a Pokemon based off of what it sounds like. I'd be like,
yeah,
be like us calling cows moos. There's a moo over there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I love my bark over here. He's such a nice bark.
Yeah. 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 I don't have a response to that. But
truth be told, though, what it sounds like is what it sounds like is the Batman villain Man Bat is kind of what it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I wonder if it had wings and arms, or if its arms were wings.
Well, its arms were wings. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't, it doesn't really go into that detail, although it does have a drawing here, like an artist's depiction of what the, what it looks like.
Did it have human features, or was it just a giant bat?
Yeah. And it does have like, the pup. So a juvenile Ohul or a pup.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting here. Ivan Sanderson.
I know that name.
Also investigated it. Yeah. I know that name because I'm reading one of his books.
Hmm.
Which is, he talks about, he wrote a book about all the UFOs really coming from under the water.
Right, so. Right. That's who that is. Absolutely. Very interesting. The Ohul. Well, if anybody out there has any sightings and has seen an Ohul, let us know, fearscapepodcast@gmail.com. In fact, if you have any cryptid sightings, let us know. We'd love to throw that in if we ever come across one of the cryptids you have seen. And, you know, of course, big shout out to our buddy, the Jersey Devil. Hey. All right, let's get moving into the UAP sighting of the week so we can get talking to Shane. So what do we got for the UAP sighting of the week?
So this comes from MUFON. I felt it fitting. Good we have a MUFON guy on tonight. We should look at MUFON. This happened in Palm Desert, California. Mm. I'm not entirely sure where that is, but I'm going to think it's probably in the desert part of California.
So southern.
Just going up. Yeah. And it's the kind of summary is a cluster of white objects in a semi-V pattern.
I was hiking today in the Bighorn area just off of Mark Smith Trailhead at 12:39 p.m. when I looked up in the northern direction facing Highway 111 and saw an east-southeast moving cluster of small, uniformly shaped white objects flying at a steady speed. The altitude is unknown, but they were near or above plane levels. There were 20 to 24 objects flying in a semi-V pattern, with the main area V-shaped and the other 50% behind, above, and below the main V-shape in the smaller clusters. They had their spacing for the most part. They were somewhat tightly packed. At first, I didn't take it too seriously, as it was in the afternoon, but also because it looked like a flock of birds. I directed my wife to look up and joked that it was a UFO. She thought they could be birds too, but upon closer examination, we saw that they were round and not moving about other than their flying in one direction. The flight was silent without any trail. It was several miles overhead. We watched it flying with slight movement in individual spaces, i.e. it wasn't a single object. We were both wearing polarized glasses, and as the objects drew further away, they became hard to see, unless we tilted our heads, whereby they were again plainly visible. I tried to get video, but couldn't capture. I didn't take it too seriously at first, and when I tried, I didn't get it in frame, as the sun was bright and the objects were far away. They then flew into a slight cloud cover and never seemed to emerge.
Yeah, that's a well. The way that it's described, it's almost like the, and I'm trying to think of how to talk about this. There's a sci-fi ship, but I can't think of it. You probably know what it is, but whenever they fly anywhere, they always had these drones that would constantly circle around the ship. I want to say it was Andromeda, which I know you hated as a show, but I think the Andromeda ship was that one of those that had like these drones that kind
Andromeda.
Of
Andromeda. I just didn't get into it like my friend Paul did.
But anyway, so that's what it almost seems like to me. Is like there's the main ship, if you will, mm-hmm. The V is the main ship, and then there's these other kind of clustery drone things that are kind of following along. Or it's potential, if you think of it like what we do in the Navy, we have typically a couple of larger ships and then several smaller support vessels.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Which reminds me of the UAP sightings that we saw, where they kept disappearing into an area that we felt like they may be going into a larger ship. So
yeah.
I don't know. Very, very interesting. So, but I did look up Palm Desert. It's kind of in the middle of the South there. It's actually right by Palm Springs and right by Coachella Valley, which I'm pretty sure is where they do the Coachella Festival every year. So,
okay.
Yep. Pretty snifty. And not too far is the Salton Sea. Just to throw that to you, to find that water. It's really not far at all. It's a big old lake, like a sea. I don't usually see seas in the United States, so
well it may have been something that was it, is it salt water, I wonder, because
I mean it's, you know, a lot of salton.
Yeah, so it, you know, typically they talk about if there's a saltwater lake, it's either fed by the ocean or it was once when the ocean was that far inland and then receded, it left behind a saltwater lake.
Right.
So.
Yeah. It says, though, I'm looking at it, it is a saline lake, so it is salty. But it says it exists right on the San Andreas fault line. So it's like if that ever like goes, it's gonna drain.
Yeah, it's like a bathtub plug, like, right? So,
yeah.
Like, so.
Oh, that's so funny, man.
That happened. I think it was like Louisiana or something. There was a really big lake, huge lake, and they were out like drilling for oil, and they drilled too far and hit an underground like river, and all the lake water drained out of the lake. I mean, they said it was like crazy just how fast it all drained out of the lake, and people were like wading out in the mud and just scooping up fish. to eat and stuff, so it's crazy. Anyways, it has nothing to do with the UFO UAP sighting, but yeah.
Well, let's get moving on. I know everybody's done hearing us jibber jabber away, so let's get to Shane Hurd, our MUFON field investigator, and our interview just right after this quick ad break.
Hey everybody, Josh here with Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. I don't know if you're like me, but I've got glasses. And one of the things that I really hate with wearing my mask is that my glasses constantly fog.
Yeah, I've got the kind of mask that you could pinch the nose and it's supposed to keep the glasses from fogging, but it still fogs. Now, sometimes I just get outside on a cold day, come back in the house, my glasses fog. Get out to pump gas, my glasses fog. So one of the things that I came across is this spray bottle that is anti-fog spray. And you spray it on and you wipe it off and then it protects your glasses and keeps them from fogging. And I'm going to tell you, this stuff is spectacular. I've even cleaned my glasses a couple of times since applying it and it still works. I also have anti-glare glasses, and this stuff is safe for anti-glare glasses. If you want to pick up your own bottle, go to fearscapepodcast.com/no more fog.
Fearscape Media Network is your new home for everything weird and enlightening. Check out podcasts and YouTube shows covering content from discussions on horror films to the paranormal to meditation. Find out more at fearscapemedia.com. All right. Welcome back to Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. Thank you guys for joining us back after the break. Like we said, we have a very special guest with us. We have Shane Hurd, author and MUFON field investigator, and he is here with us. Hey, Shane, how's it going?
Hey, guys, man? How you doing?
Doing really good.
Fantastic.
I'm doing good. And one of the cool things, I don't remember if we mentioned this in our intro yet or not, Josh, but one of the things that I really liked about this is that Shane is out here in the Phoenix area, same as me. He's already, that means that just in the short time I've been here, I have seen more UFO activity than I've ever seen. Like, good Lord, man. So that's exciting to have our first Phoenix guest on here. Well, I guess second, because we had the Longhorn guy on here.
Yeah. So
he's a parent. He's a ghost guy.
Which, you know, I mean, talk about, though, Stefan, that, you know, you've seen a lot of UFOs. Mm-hmm. And just to kind of kick things off here a little bit with Shane, you know, I would imagine, though, that Stefan, you know, even though we try to do, like, we use some apps and stuff to try to basically debunk what we're seeing or to classify or explain what we're seeing, and where we're mm-hmm. where we can't, we classify that ourselves as a UFO. But Shane, you're pretty much, as a field investigator, that's what your sole purpose is, right? Is to basically look at something and try to find an explanation, and whatever can't be explained must be a UFO.
Yeah, it really is. It's a process of elimination. And you go for the most obvious and work your way down. And so, you know, obvious things that are probably the most prevalent thing that occurs for people is a misidentification of something that's pretty prosaic. So, you know, planet mm-hmm. Venus, these are going to sound like a cliche, but they are, because they are right. commonly mistaken. Or, you know, right. aircraft and satellites and drones and, you know, weather activity and all sorts of things. So, yeah, the investigation process really starts with that elimination of the most obvious. Yeah.
Right. Yep. I remember yep. when Mars was really, really close to the moon a few months back, and everybody was like, I've seen an orange UFO by the moon. And, you know, you had to say, well, was it moving? Well, no, but it was orange. Yeah. You know, and to say, hey, it was Mars.
Well, and it's, we just as part of the segments that we do leading up to the interview, we were talking about how the FAA just basically said, okay, now drones, commercial drones, can now fly at night. Yeah. And that's just gonna, that's probably gonna spike a lot of UFO sightings,
much like Starlink did.
Like Starlink did. Yeah.
Yeah. Drones are sort of the bane of our existence because, you know, they're mm-hmm. becoming rather ubiquitous. And like you said, now they're going to be able to fly at night. And you know, at a distance, they can look quite strange. And, you know, they're outfitted with lights and, you know, sure. LEDs. And, you know, they look quite strange. And then, of course, depending on how big they are yeah. and how far away, they can look really bizarre. So, yeah, that's definitely an issue for us.
Yeah, it sucks. Well, an LED. Between that and Starlink, you know, it's like, that's a skeptic's wet mm-hmm. dream. They can immediately just say,
I mean, it was more than likely a drone.
But it's always done. The devil's in the details, you know? And that's that's why we have an investigative process that helps you, you know, really identify or eliminate those sorts of things. So you can't just lazily say, oh, that was a drone, or that was, you know, a helicopter or whatever. No, you've got to do your due diligence as an investigator. You got to present evidence. You got to document it. And really, when I do a case, I almost look at it like preparation of a court case. How am I going to defend my investigation, my logic, and my conclusion? And so that's really, you know, part of it. So as an investigator, you have to be very neutral. And, you know, we all have bias, whether we want to admit it or not. But you really have to set that bias aside so that you can remain neutral and you look at all of the evidence and let the evidence speak for itself.
I always think of Scully in X-Files, how like from like episode one, she was already seeing stuff. But the very next episode, she'd still be like, I just don't know if any of that stuff's real. Yeah. And I'm like, come on, Scully, you just saw an alien walk up and touch you on the face. But she did. She always remained neutral no matter what she saw.
Well, and so much of this stuff, you know, the responsibility or onus, if you will, for proof is on the seer, right? Because for them to be able to make a strong enough case, like you've said, like a legal case, to be without a shadow of a doubt to say we can't explain what this is, therefore it's unexplainable, therefore it's UFO. I think where a lot of people get hung up and where I've seen, we talked a little bit about this before, the switch now to UAP is that so many people associate UFO with alien. And it's not that it's an alien craft. It's just, we don't know what it is. It's unidentified.
Yeah, very true.
Because it's been so closely associated with sci-fi.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the things I do talk about, especially in my book, in fact, it's the first chapter, is correct terminology because it's powerful. So, for example, UFO, unidentified flying object, that was a term coined by the Air Force in about 1953. And the idea behind it was a way to as accurately describe what was seen in a way that they could categorize and sort it. So when you look at it, you're talking an object. But with UAP, it's different. Unidentified aerial phenomena. So it may not be an object. So like today, you've probably seen videos on YouTube and all sorts of stuff where you'll see maybe the spiral in the sky or orbs, plenty of orbs, lights in the sky, and other things like that, that you cannot in a critical way say it's an object. It's a light and you assume there's an object, but you can't make an assumption. You have to look for evidence. So that term was much less loaded than the UFO because of pop culture and that over the years. And it really started to be used in military circles, again, to allow a consideration of the topic without that baggage, that sci-fi or pop culture baggage. This was more of a scientific term, and it allowed to, you know, the military and other scientists to, you know, discuss it without that whole baggage. So, you know, I'm a fan of UFO because I think it's historical and I think it's meaningful, but at the same time, I understand I also use UAP, and it depends on my audience, who I'm speaking to. You know,
and not only audience, but it depends on what it is you're seeing too. Absolutely. Right. You know, we talked about that a lot, that, you know, if it is indeed something flying, I'm more apt to use UFO. But if it looks like some sort of light that's like phasing in and out, that could be some sort of hologram or something along those lines, I may use UAP a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, or something on the ground.
Well, and I've heard, another breakout of UAP is unidentified aquatic phenomenon. And I don't know how widely that's being used, but just, you know, things that like the one of the videos from 2017 that were recently confirmed, you know, that whole thing, that interview that with the pilot started with, it was kind of around the ocean, like it was interested in whatever was happening right. in the ocean, and so that was more of an sequest. It was more of an aquatic activity that then became aerial later on in the exercise.
Yeah, so. Absolutely, and that I think is an area that is largely unexplored. The underwater UFOs or USOs or UAP in the context you use, because that very case, the 2004 Nimitz case, for example, you know, it made that direct connection between these objects and the water, coming out of the water, having some association with it. Of course, there's always been people who felt like, well, there's underwater bases. Though we don't have any proof of that, you know, it's a logical thing to pursue, I think, in terms of research. And and there are efforts underway to do that.
You know, one of the things that I've looked at extensively is trying to understand correlations. So I know, you know, when you go out and do an investigation, you might look at maybe some past experiences or past sightings or things like that, or even some past cases that were quote unquote debunked as a reference point for what this case might be. But do you actually look at any, or does anybody that you know of look at correlations between confirmed sightings to see, are these all taking place within a certain period of time, a certain day, a certain time of the day, and so on and so forth?
Absolutely. Like it's a key part of every investigation. So, for example, someone makes a report to MUFON. They submit it on MUFON.com. It gets triaged, sort of, which really assigns a level of importance. So you've all heard of close encounters of the first kind, second, third kind, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then in combination with Dr. Jacques Vallée, created a scale that, you know, identifies the type of sighting. So like a flyby or something that makes maneuvers. And this combination of triage then assigns an importance level, basically. And then it's assigned to the local region where that sighting occurred. And the reason for that is, for example, myself here, I'm located in Phoenix. I'm the assistant director of Arizona MUFON, and MUFON is set up as it's an international organization, and it has a national structure. And then under that national, each state or regions have a local chapter. And the reason is because any investigation is really geographically centric. In other words, it's almost like an investigative reporter. You need to know what, when, where, and those are all geographic. And then hopefully you can identify the who and the why if you identify those other things. And so then, you know, you have this very, you know, specific set of research data points that you go for. So things like, hey, what was the weather? What was the temperature? What was the dew point? You know, what was the moon phase? You know, we use an application called Stellarium, and it's a wonderful astronomy application. You can put in coordinates, date and time, and it'll display what was in the sky. I mean, even 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And so then you can, you know, eliminate that possibility. Hey, was this Venus? Was it, you know, up and out at that time or whatever?
Right.
And then one of the things we always do is correlate between MUFON, and I look for other reports, because I might get assigned a single report, but there might be another one in my area that they're related. We also check with NUFORC, which is the National UFO Reporting Center by Peter Davenport in Washington State. And though they don't investigate, they at least record, you know, sightings.
Yeah.
And so again, we look for those correlations. And then if you've ever seen the MUFON report that you submit, I think it has some 200 data points. I mean, things like, you know.
Oh, yeah. I reported one back in July. Yeah.
Oh, you did? Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, yeah. A really, really fantastic one. And it was a lot to put down, and I was thankful for that.
So. Yeah, it does. It walks a person through and elicits details that they might not have been conscious that they had. And then when asked about it, it's, oh, yeah, I did see that, or it did make a noise, or it didn't make a noise, or blah, 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 whatever it may be. So then, you know, the idea is, you know, this is a database. There's in excess of 100,000 reports in the MUFON database. And you can search by all these different data points, and you can, you know, as you said, look for a correlation. Hey, did, you know, was there a triangular shaped UFO reported in this area, or how many over how many years? How come, you know, in this zip code, you know, there's been 7 triangles seen over 15 years or whatever,
right,
you know?
Right.
So, I mean, it is, it's any data that you can, you know, research, record, it's just incredibly valuable.
Well, something that I have noticed with all of the sightings that I've had and some of the sightings that I've heard about and research for, like, all the stuff that was researched as part of Project mm-hmm. Blue Book, is they all took place near water. So that was something that I started to draw. So it gets back to our aquatic conversation, mm-hmm. Is that, you know, are these things, you know, John Keel, you know, he had some faults, but he also did a really good job in the book, Operation Trojan Horse, of laying out a lot of UFO accounts from like the 1800s and the early 1900s. And a lot of those accounts, it talks about how a craft would land, beings would get out, and they would ask for a bucket of water.
Right.
And so it makes you think, you know, even when you think about, you know, Star Trek and stuff, you know, they would have had a limited water supply on board, but then if they needed more water, they would have to go somewhere and get water. So,
like Voyager, that's what they had to do. They had to go find water.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it makes you think that how many of these craft are you know, going to a water location or coming from a water location. Maybe the crash in Roswell happened because they ran out of water. I mean,
yeah, what if water was fuel for them? Yeah. Like, that's something I've always thought about too.
And
one of the good reasons we could have these underwater bases.
Yeah. And we don't know. I mean, you know, there's many possibilities, right? And and you don't want to exclude any possible explanation. I mean, that's the thing. You have to be open-minded and you know, non-judgmental, because the fact is we know so little, and we tend to be anthropocentric, which in essence means we see everything from the human point of view, right? Like us, we need water, you know, we got to drink it. A couple of days without it, we die. I mean, it's that important to us. And so it's natural for us to think, hey, they must need water too, right? However, you know, and you know, I think that's very possible. But on the other hand, maybe they're silicone based or something, and they don't need water. The fact is, we just don't know. So that's why we always have to be open-minded, skeptical in a healthy way. You know, we don't want to just dismiss things because they just don't fit our anthropocentric thinking. I think that's the point I'm trying to make.
So something else that I wanted to ask about, and I don't know, something that Stefan and I and I think a few others have recently been thinking about, and again, I'll tie back to Keel just because I've done a lot of reading of Keel over the last year, is this kind of a look at things holistically, look at all the paranormal holistically. I don't know if anybody has looked at, you know, 2 days before there was 5 UFO sightings, there were 2 Bigfoot sightings. Are any of those things related? You know, to look at all the paranormal.
Right, there was a massive haunting that took place that a lot of people saw right around the same time. We noticed that correlation, if you'll remember it, in the Enfield haunting. Remember the one in London in the 70s? We looked up and there was a massive UFO flap that happened the same time in that same area, which was very interesting. So who knows?
Yeah, actually, when I conduct an investigation and interview someone, I always ask them to explain to me, first of all, did you have any other weird things happen before or after? you know. Yeah. How are you feeling that day? You know, what was going on? Don't tell me just about the incident, that the 30-second incident.
Right.
Tell me what did you feel like when you woke up in the morning? Were you having dreams? Were you, you know what I mean? Because you're right, there at times is correlating evidence or experiences that I think people would more interpret as paranormal. And then, you know, you have to be aware of the fact that some people in ufology are very nuts and bolts. And I have to admit, when I got into it, that's the way I saw it. And what I mean by that is, hey, that's a physical object in the sky. You know, it came from somewhere. There's someone in it. They're showing up, right, looking around, and then they go away, and that's that. But that does not fully describe what we're seeing. That explanation is not enough. And then you have other people who, you know, feel very much so that this is more paranormal than nuts and bolts. Or and then now I'm of the opinion, having been an investigator for, you know, over 100 cases and been at this for 3, 4, 5 years, it's really both. And we don't know, we don't completely understand it. But again, if I were to dogmatically say there's nothing paranormal and it's not related, I would be missing the boat there, because the evidence is suggestive that that's not the case, that there is some correlation. This is bigger. So yeah, the whole Bigfoot thing, maybe why is Bigfoot seen all the time, but we don't have bones and we don't have scat and we don't have remains, right, and all those things? Well, maybe one of the explanations is that thing is interdimensional. It comes and goes from somewhere else to here. That's why we see evidence of it living, you know, eating and all that kind of stuff. But we're seeing it.
Well, and think about
like
all
UFOs.
Think about all the people that have gone missing in the world, right? We've never found their bodies. We've never found their bones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to say maybe there's not that many Sasquatch out there, and maybe we're just not finding them. Like, we're not finding these missing people, mm-hmm, right? Like, you know, if you've ever seen the Missing 411 and stuff like that, right, a lot of that's in the forests and the like. But one thing I wanted to say was, this is very interesting because there's a lot of debate, and there is a lot more now. People in the community are becoming a larger community now instead of these pod communities. But it reminds me of back in the 50s and 60s, you know, where there was a huge disconnect between UFO sightings and contactee sightings. You know, they were not the same groups. You had people like Alan Greenfield and Gray Barker and Keel and those guys and Adamski and all them saying, hey, you know, there's contactees. These guys are just as important than the UFO community. It was like, no, it's making us look bad. And I think that was what was happening here the last 10 years was, you know, that was what it was too. It's like they were accepting that contactees and UFO sightings were similar, but oh, don't put ghosts or don't put cryptids in the boat. Now we're seeing that. But that's something I love about MUFON. I love that, you know, you guys ask for sightings, for a contact or a sighting or abduction or entities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very, very brave. And it shows how far we've progressed as a community.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. It's more evidence. And it's, you know, too many people are having too many experiences to discount it. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, when I first got interested in UFOs, you know, I wasn't sure that it was real, but the more I got involved, the more I studied it, then began participating and having investigations, you know, I realized this, that it isn't just a question of evidence. There's proof. Proof is there is a phenomena. Now, what it is, don't know yet, but there's no denying it. And of course, today we have the benefit of the United States Navy coming out and ponying up and saying, yeah, this phenomenon is in fact real. We don't know what it is, which is great. I'm fine with that. Don't feed me, you know, line of crap. Tell me the truth. You don't know what it is. Yep. We don't know what it is. Fine. Now, but let's get there by studying it, you know, in a scientific way.
Right.
And that's kind of the difference, right? People you know, scientific community, the government, they did not want to touch that aspect of it, with the abductions and the contact, because it,
right,
it doesn't play into our Western materialistic culture and the thinking that we have. And from a military standpoint, and rightly so, I will say, they have to look at it from a perspective of threat, right? We want our military to protect us from threat. And when there's something unknown, unidentified, you have to at least interpret that there's a possibility that it's a threat until you eliminate that possibility. And so I know a lot of people with the TTSA, the Nimitz case, the Roosevelt case, and everything that's going mm-hmm. on now, you yep. kind of have some people in the UFO community who are offended that it's being, you know, presented as a threat or a possible threat.
Like Stephen Greer, yeah. he's very against
and,
that.
And I can understand contactees and those who've had abductions and they were a positive experience, that might feel offensive to them. But I'm pretty sure, certain too, that people who've had an abduction and a very negative experience probably would be supportive of the idea that they're potentially a threat. But in terms of military, we want them to consider it a threat until they've, you know, identified it and eliminated that possibility. And frankly, anything that can behave and perform like they do is the technology so far more advanced than ours that they would be a threat if they so chose. I love what Nick Pope used to say about that, you know, threat analysis. It's basically used this illustration. For example, the United States has nuclear weapons. That's threatening to any nation on Earth, okay? But from the perspective mm-hmm. of the United Kingdom, they would look at our nuclear weapons and say, okay, is there a threat? The first analysis is capability. Yeah, they have the capability to annihilate us. But the second part is, what is their intent? What is the probability that they would use that capability against us? And so, oh, we're allies. Well, then that's no threat. But do you see that? You could.
Right, which is the opposite was the Cold War, because we didn't know what Russia was going to do with theirs, right?
So yeah, exactly.
I get that, yeah.
So,
well, and I was just going to say, when you think about resource to understand and solve the problem, you know, the U.S. military has the resource capability that no other private organization on Earth has. Mm-hmm. And so, honestly, if you were to go before, you know, committees in Congress and so on and forth and say, hey, we want to investigate this, we don't know what it is, we need to understand the threat level, they're more likely, I think, to appropriate funding to understand what the threat is versus, hey, we just want to randomly look into this phenomenon and see what it is.
For sure. So. And in fact, you know, I'm sure that's been the argument that got the bill passed recently, submitted by Marco mm-hmm, right. Rubio on the Intelligence Committee, to, you know, get the Defense Department to pony up a report in 6 months about all the UFO research and activity. And again, you probably aren't going to get that just because it's scientifically interesting. You know, they're going to push the, hey, this could be a threat issue, which again, I'm supportive of, because not because I think that it is, but because, you know, I think that it could be. And you want that analysis to be done, you know, and like you said, with the resources that can really, really cut it. So like we've seen with the, you know, radars and, you know, all the things that they have at their disposal.
Yeah, and I think it takes a lot of hubris too to think that it's either only a threat or either only good intentions, to think that it's only one species out there, right? Or whatnot. It could be both. It could be all. You know, we have to. And that's the one thing I hope, that even with the new task force and everything like that, that they are looking at it from all angles, that it isn't just, you know, the Russia of the stars, but, you know, something, multiple things or multiple dimensions or whatnot. Or do they even already know because of the secret space program? I'm just saying.
No, really good point. That is a great point. I mean, look at humans. We have good ones and bad ones. We have good nations and bad nations, right? We have, you know, good intent and bad intent. And then we have accidents,
right.
You know, we know we're imperfect and we, you know, and again, we think anthropocentrically and we might project that on alien life. And maybe it's true and maybe it's not. But I mean, we have to be open-minded and consider all possibilities.
Right.
Even on that level.
Yep. Well, and I think though that, you know, to the point of like you said, if you have had a good experience with contact or being abducted, you might be offended by the perception of threat. But also, it would not behoove us to just assume good intent, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why that analysis has to be done. So I mean, I think it's fair. As long as which we would honestly probably never know, as long as they don't come back secretly and say, hey, there's no threat, but then publicly say, hey, there's a threat, so that they can get, you know, money to go off and build, you know, weapons or spaceships or whatever the case may be. So but like I said, we would never know what they decide on secretly versus what they give public.
Right. And even the report they give us isn't they're not gonna give us the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah. I try not to be cynical, but I look at the last 70 years experience of let's say Blue Book, for example, and the government's willingness to tell us the truth. And I don't really see that there's much incentive on their side to do so. However, things are changing because, you know, I think it is driven by things like, for example, the discovery of exoplanets. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, nobody, I mean, at least the scientific community and most people would not think or admit that there is life elsewhere in the universe. And then with the discovery of these exoplanets and then the number of them, now even the scientific community, we see NASA come out saying, yeah, you know what? It's crazy to think that there isn't life elsewhere. So I think that kind of broke the taboo from a scientific standpoint. I mean, they're taking baby steps. Don't get me wrong. They're not going to admit much, but the door has been opened.
Well, and a lot of it is the church doesn't have as much hold as it used to at one point, you know, and a lot of, you know, religions are kind of coming around to this idea as well. Like they're accepting it a little bit more too.
What was it? Something I read recently, I think it was like 2009, the Catholic Church with underneath the Pope actually put together a plan for, if we make contact, here's how you as believers can interpret that contact in relation to what you believe.
Yeah, in fact,
the
go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, you know, the Vatican astronomer has been all about for a very long time about extraterrestrial life.
Yeah.
He's been a big proponent of it. I don't know if it's still the same guy because he was pretty old when I saw him last time, but I know that they're pretty, they're pretty around it. So.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I had a strong religious background myself in a typical Christian religion that was, you know, like, oh, don't look into that stuff. It's, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I thought the Vatican actually had a very brilliant response to that. Most people thought, oh, the government's not going to reveal this because, you know, religions would topple and crumble and people would lose their minds. But, you know, the Catholic Church did something just, I thought it was brilliant. They just said, well, if there are aliens, we'll be happy to baptize them too. You know what I mean?
That's what I've always said that. Like, brilliant. I've never understood that. Like,
we don't have to undo our entire history.
More missionaries.
We don't have to change our dogma. Fine. What applies to us can apply to them too. So I thought that was brilliant. They didn't
now you don't just have to go to Mumbai, you can go to Sirius 4 and do your missionary work.
Hey, and just on a side note, you know, the Vatican has a telescope here in Arizona on Mount Graham. A telescope.
I was just looking up that just made
pretty cool. That it was a big deal when it came online because there was an environmental issue, the red squirrel, I think it was, and it postponed it for a couple of years, but they finally got it done. And Yeah, and that telescope has discovered some pretty interesting stuff. So I don't know. Sorry, that was just a little Arizona plug there.
No, I love that. I love learning about everything around here. So
pretty sure I know where Stefan's going this weekend.
So. Right. Yeah. I'm already looking it up.
Yeah.
But I do want to swing this back around to you a little bit. It shows, that you've been, you joined MUFON in 2015 and became a field investigator in 2017 and blah, blah, blah. But before all that, what got you your interest into ufology and, seeking and learning and then the eventual joining of MUFON?
Yeah. Like I mentioned, I was, a member of a religious organization and just wouldn't touch it. Although I kind of had a mild interest, but I, between that and being a young man and, starting a career and raising a family. And back then the taboo was very strong. And I just would not go there, right? But what happened in 1997 on March 13th was the Phoenix Lights incident.
Yeah, the Phoenix Lights. Yeah.
And though I didn't see it that night, the ensuing media and all that stuff really got my attention. And, I thought, wow, that's in my own backyard. And it did spark my interest, but I really didn't do anything with it. But now it was kind of a little ember in there glowing. And then I decided around 2010 that I might kind of start looking into it a little more secretly, because I'd been watching like the UFO Files, and then, the UFO Hunters came on, and there started to be some good programming on it. And the first book I read was The Day After Roswell by Bill Burns and Philip Corso. And I read that.
Oh, well, I just ordered that.
Yeah. When I read it, I kind of thought, I didn't have a very positive view of it. Let's just put it that way. I thought it was a bit dubious. And I almost just gave up. But it just so happened, Linda Cain's book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Public Officials Go on the Record, came out. And that book convinced me. I mean, she's an investigative journalist. She wasn't a UFO person. And she profiled all these very, very strong cases and approached it like an investigative journalist. And it was just cogent, and it was logical, and it was reasonable. And so that really spurred me on. And then from there, I've read hundreds of books and, DVDs and just the whole thing. And I got to this point where I'm like, and I'm not trying to be arrogant, I'm just saying, I have all this knowledge now. I've learned all of this stuff. What the heck am I gonna do with it? I wanted to do more. I wanted to play, I wanted to participate, I wanted to contribute. And I've been in government for the last 20 some years. And I had a very successful career in a technical position. And I knew I could thrive in a organizational structure. And when I looked at ufology, there really wasn't much out there except for MUFON. And so I joined MUFON just as a member and got the journal and kind of, started to begin absorbing sort of that culture and stuff. And I found that I liked it. And so I decided to become an investigator. I went through the training and the process and began investigating cases. And I just absolutely love it. Because to me, it was a way where I could contribute, I could participate. I was kind of in the know. There was a purpose and a point to it. People would have these experiences and just, bust a gut trying to figure out what to do with it. They're afraid to tell people, they'll get laughed at. But MUFON was a place where they would be treated with dignity and respect and, all of that. And that really appealed to me. And I found out I kind of had a knack for it. It was really up my alley. And, I've been going full steam ahead since that time, to the extent that I even, wrote this book recently. And, I'm just having the time of my life. I'm about ready to retire, and I'll be able to devote even more time to MUFON and that experience. But, it's put me in touch with so many great people, and it's just been so fun. And people in ufology are awesome. I mean, I've had dinner with, I'm going to name drop a little, just, and the reason I'm doing
Do it
is I want people to know that if you are, you know, interested in this, it's a social culture as well. And, you know, the people are really mm-hmm. great. So, you know, I've had dinner with Richard Dolan. I've hung out with Stan Friedman. You know, I'm friends with Ryan Sprague and Jason McClellan and Maureen Ellsbury and, you know, Alejandro Rojas. And, you know Tom DeLong. I met Jim Semivan. And, you know, I can just go on and on and on. And, yeah, you know, it's they are friendly. They, you know, will engage you. And it's just, man, I'm just loving it. It's so fun. So I encourage anybody that has the interest, get involved. I mean, here in Phoenix, we have a really great chapter. I have to brag. But every month, with the exception of COVID, you know, we have these fantastic speakers like Richard Dolan, Linda Moulton Howe, you name it. They come to Phoenix. We, you know, they speak to a couple hundred people. We go out to lunch, and then we go hang out by a campfire. Yeah,
see, that's what I'm looking forward yeah. to getting into out here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is, it, you know, it's got a scientific bent to it, which really appeals to me, but it's got a social bent to it. And, you know, it's mm-hmm. you know, doing with it what you want, you know, and you can make it what you want. And I just can't, you know, speak any more highly of it. It's a fantastic and fun thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I can say that's the same for us with this show. I mean, you know, that's why we started this show, is investigating these things. And it all keeps leading back to UAPs for us. But, you know, we investigate everything. And through this, we've got to meet some amazing people. Yeah. And it's just, I encourage everyone to just keep researching, because our community is very giving and very amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know,
well, I was just going to say, I just became a member of MUFON. We've been receiving the MUFON newsletters, mm-hmm. You know, kind of like the updated mm-hmm. Report sightings and for the quarter and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we report on the quarterly every time.
Yeah.
But, you know, for about a year. But I also just myself became a member about a couple months ago, and started looking into the, you know, the investigation process and how do you become an investigator, because it just sounds really cool. And I am very, Stefan would attest, I'm a very logical mm-hmm. Type thinker. And so I think it would be good.
We are definitely like, not to sound, you know, cheesy, but we are definitely Mulder and Scully. I'm like, this ring in front of me is a UFO. And he's like, no, that's the light you have shining on you right now. I'm like, okay.
But you know what? There's but room it works for both, good. Right? There's really room for
exactly.
both.
Exactly.
And that's the beauty of this thing. You are not, you know, you don't all have to be square pegs in a square hole. That, and right. these many perspectives are incredibly valuable, because, again, an investigation in these UFOs, it's not black and white. It's a world of gray, you know, yeah. and you need those yeah. those perspectives yep. and those personalities and that viewpoint. And so, no, I'm sure you guys would be great at it. And if you need any help, you just let me know. I will be glad to help you guys.
Oh, yeah. You and I will definitely be talking okay, since we're cool. close by, because I really want to get involved in some stuff out here.
Since you live here in Phoenix, you know, the next meeting, I'm going to hook you up and we'll go and you can
yeah,
check it out for yourself.
Please do, because I would love to. I would absolutely love to. I mean, this is – I love this stuff, man. And
so I did want to – you know, we're kind of, I think, probably getting close to wrapping up, but I wanted to ask one quick question. So in all the investigations that you've done, have you ever had to do your own investigation, your own sighting investigation?
No, but what happened for me, I submitted a report to MUFON. I was a MUFON member, but not an investigator. It's something that occurred here at mm-hmm. my home. And I got video of it. I submitted it. It got investigated. Unfortunately, it was on the iPhone 6 Plus, but it was at the time where you would, you know, run out of memory. And I'm videoing this thing, mm-hmm. and after 58 seconds, it stops because of the stupid, you know, ran out of storage, disk space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the really extraordinary performance of the object was not recorded. Now I saw it with my naked eye, and the whole thing. So MUFON, the investigator at the time, I think, called it a drone. But with hindsight, now as an investigator, I understand why they thought that was the most likely explanation, because they didn't see what I saw. And just my testimony on it, I mean, you know, it was just one of those things. But it was very, very unusual thing. And I've got the video. I'll send you guys if you want, just so you can check it out. But
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, this is the nature of investigation, you know. Again, it's
right.
We don't know. And, you know, I love that poster. I bet you guys have the poster. I've got the poster that says, I want to believe. And, you know, that's that craft is from, I think, Poland and whatever. But at any rate, the whole I want to believe thing, no, I want to know. You know, I don't want to be a believer. I spent 35 years in religion as a believer. I'm done with that. I don't want to believe. No, I want to know. And so that's the approach
I take
with UFOs. I don't want to believe. I want to know. And how are you going to know? Facts, evidence, proof. And, you know,
facts and evidence.
We don't have it yet. Or if someone has it, it's not being shared yet. But it's feeling like, you know, that's coming. Now, I don't have any inside information, anything more than you guys, but there's what's happened in the last 3 years is truly remarkable. More has happened in terms of disclosure or confirmation, whatever term you want to use, in the last 3 years than happened the prior 70 years, in my opinion. Now, I wasn't alive, or I was alive in the 60s, but I was a little kid, but I mean, ufology in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s was pretty exciting, I think, when you look back at the documentation and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, we are really close to, you know, we know more today than we ever have, let's put it that way. So it's really an exciting time.
Well, because disclosure can't just be, yes, there are UFOs, because we've already established that. So now disclosure has to be more than that. It's the master's degree version, right? So that's what I'm excited about. But before we get out of here, I did also want to give you an opportunity to talk about your book, The Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, A Beginner's Guide to Researching UFOs, available on Amazon. I love this because years ago, when I first got into ghosts and stuff, I found a very similar book, but for ghost hunting, and it was pretty layman's, and it really helped me understand, as your book does too. And so I'd love for you to just quickly talk about your book a little bit.
Yeah, I wrote it really because of the point in time that you know, I gained this knowledge, I've gained this experience, and right at the time that, you know, these new disclosures have come out, particularly with TTSA and so forth, and how the media began treating it respectfully, right? So there wasn't, you know, X-Files music every time and the reporters giggle. Now it's treated, you know, respectfully.
Right.
And I think what that meant to me was, look, there is a whole lot of Shanes out there who are interested but wouldn't, you know, express that interest because of fear of what family and friends and so forth, and the taboo and the ridicule that comes with it. And so I'm thinking there's a lot of people who are interested and who are going to be willing to dip their toe in that water, not to mention shows like Ancient Aliens, you know, which has changed the whole topic, whether it be religious or scientific, you know, causing people to think out of the box, let's put it that way. And so, and I thought, well, you know, when I first started, I had to kind of dig through, I call it in the book, wheat and chaff. There was a whole lot of chaff I had to go through, right? You know, stupid videos on YouTube, you know, nonsense stuff, you know, all these rabbit holes. And, you know, it was a waste of time and it was discouraging. So what I've done with this book is, look, this, for a beginner, if you're newly interested in this, these are the topics that you would want to consider. These are the good ones. These are the bad ones. You know, this is the process. This is what good information looks like. You know, it's what bad information looks and sounds like. And then just talked about, you know, all the big issues. And it's pretty straightforward. It's like 10 chapters. And each of them is just, you know, I list things like, you know, what is UAP? I devote a whole chapter to talking about what it is. And then things like misidentification, hoaxes, the scientific method, how that has to be applied, different forms of evidence, you know, and then I talk about classic cases that are a good model for people to understand, and again, what's good and what isn't. And then I talk about like the cover up, and that's real. And then I talk about, you know, the political science of ufology, things like why did the governments act like that, you know, and there's good reason for that. So it's just those big issues, but, you know, enough detail that people can, you know, get involved, not waste a bunch of time. And hopefully we'll have a whole new generation of people interested, because I'm an old dude, I'm 60 years old. And, you know, a lot of the older ones are passing before our very eyes. So it's a really sad thing. So I wanted to get the younger generation involved and interested, and just create a path to get involved without wasting a bunch of time or getting discouraged.
Yep, I love that. I mean, I just recently, my sister, who is a medium, and she's a big into ghosts and spirits, she admitted to Josh and I when we had her on recently that she doesn't believe in UFOs and aliens. And I was like, what? Like, I had no idea. And it just blew my mind, all the stuff that she believes in. But yet her son, who is 12, I was out with him, and he was like, Uncle Stefan, I just want you to know that I really believe in UFOs. And he had this long conversation with me, and I was like, that's my nephew, you know. And it's there, and this is a perfect like book for me to give to him, because he's really interested. He's like, listens to our show, and he's like, how do I do this and stuff. So this is perfect, you know. He's right at that perfect age to understand that, and I appreciate that, and I thank you for writing something something that's just not you know, hard to understand. So really appreciate that. And like I said, you can find that on Amazon, as well as, Joshua, we have that on our website as well.
We will.
The link to it on our resources tab there.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Josh?
Well, I was just going to say I'm definitely going to pick up a copy, because I think it's a good introduction to field work, if you will, for me to really understand and gauge if this is something that I definitely want to get into.
Yeah. So. And
and the beauty part is that it fits into some other fields too, even like looking into cryptids and even hell troop crime. I mean, it's like some of that scientific method and things like that flows right into investigating most damn near anything. So
yeah, good point. And I agree with that. There's definitely a process, and I do talk about that. And, you know, there's maybe one chapter that's a little deep and stuff, but it's typically written, again, with you know, somebody new in mind, and, you know, I try not to go, you know, too deep and too complex, but, you know, hopefully, I mean, I've had some good feedback for it, and, you know, I would just love to hear what anyone thinks about it if they have a chance to read it.
Absolutely. Cool. Absolutely. And before we go, I got one crazy question for you. Well, I guess we got to ask what we normally ask our guests. So if they're UFO people, we usually ask, you know, how do you feel about ghosts and cryptids and stuff? Have you had any like hauntings or anything like that happen?
I've not had a personal experience, but I have been interested in it and researching it myself. And there's a group here called PAPS, Phoenix Area Paranormal Society, and I've linked up with Jamie Veich, who is a member of that, and we keep trying to get together again. COVID kind of limited that, but I was going to speak at one of their events, but I'm definitely interested, and for the fact that I think that having that knowledge may help me with UFOs. Or there may in fact be a link. And again, I don't want to, you know, limit my imagination. I don't want to limit my body of knowledge. And I'm not going to, you know, turn down, you know, information that I think could be useful. So, you know, both personally, but as an investigator as well. So, yeah, I definitely am aware that too is a real phenomenon. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
Very cool. And then that leads me to the last question I was going to ask you, because this is the thing I don't ever hear about, was being a Phoenix person. Do you think there, because it's weird that in the same year, not only do we have Phoenix lights, but we had the Hale-Bopp comet. And do you think there's any correlation between the two?
You know, I think, well, I would could say I know that the I remember being where I was that night, and I was looking at the comet. We went to a friend's house, had a telescope out in the desert. We had dinner, and we were right. getting together for the purpose of looking at that. Now, if there was any intention behind it, you had a whole lot of people in Phoenix who were out that night for the purpose of looking at the comet who yeah. had the experience of seeing the craft. So is there some yeah. intention behind that? I can't say, but it is an interesting fact.
Right. It's like, where are the lights? Where are they crashed? Coming to get a good view of Hale Bopp too, right? You know, like we do in boats for fireworks.
You know, that's something that that I really been really thinking about lately is it's almost like the whatever is involved with UAPs and UFOs, it's almost like the sightings have increased so much that they're basically saying, hey, you tell them. Saying you to the governments of the world, you tell them or we will. Right. And if you take that kind of thought process and you look at Phoenix Lights, it's like, hey, we know that this is highly publicized. People are going to be out looking at this comet. So this is a great opportunity for us to have a mass sighting that can't be so easily debunked.
That was a freaking parade. It was a parade. Yeah. There were more than one. Thousands of people saw it. In fact, even here in Arizona, our MUFON meetings, we meet at the Arizona Historical Museum, and the museum has a display, and it's their most popular display of the Phoenix Light
incident. I bet.
And MUFON helped put that thing together. So in Arizona,
I know where I'm going
deal.
Next week.
Yeah. So yeah, you can come check it out when you go to the
Fantastic.
Meeting.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Shane, thank you so much, man. Well, this has been just I could talk to you for hours and I will.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for coming on.
You
are welcome on here anytime, man. Like, okay. You know, you let us know if you got anything, another book coming out or just some crazy cool sighting.
Yeah. I've got some cases I'll tell you about next time.
Absolutely.
Right. Sounds great.
But yeah, thank you so much, man. We respect your knowledge and we're just so thankful that you came out. And you know, I know our listeners appreciate it as well.
Well, thanks for so much for having me, and like you said, I could talk about this subject for hours too. It's just flat out fun.
All right, well, let's get moving on then, and let's get things wrapped up. Okay, big thank you to Shane Heard. Thank you so much, Shane. Make sure to get on Amazon again and look up Shane Heard, H-U-R-D, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, A Beginner's Guide to Researching UFOs. You can get it on Kindle or you can get a hardcover, I believe. Just get on there, check it out. And of course, you know, you got to check out MUFON.
Yeah.
That's just MUFON.com. It's real simple. Just get on there and check all that out, man. Like, we love MUFON.
Yeah. And if you sign up on, like, you don't have to become a member. They have a mailing list you can sign up for. It's pretty neat. Like, we, you know, we've talked about it past in the show. Mm-hmm. They send out the, you know, quarterly, like, here's how many sightings we had in different countries and all that kind of stuff. And that's really neat to see. But if you actually want to get to where you can, like, look at the database of sighting information and stuff like that, then you do have to be a member. But they're also, their memberships are not badly priced either. Mm-mm. So
no, and they hold conventions and stuff every year, of course, you know, not recently, but they have local chapters and all kinds of fun stuff which you heard about. So but yeah, check all that stuff out. But Josh, I want to get out of here, but of course, before we get out of here, we got to get into our listener story this week. This one comes from a actual friend of my father's who found out I was doing a podcast and wanted to send in a story. He's into the paranormal. His name's Greg Jezanowski. He's from Ohio. And this is his story that he sent me.
Hey, guys. Have a good one. It still gives me chills thinking about it. I was home alone with my dog. I was watching TV, laying on the couch covered with a blanket. Dog was laying across from me by the chair. It was about 2 or 3 a.m. I was barely awake, trying to finish watching a movie. And all of a sudden, I felt the blanket pull back from my shoulders, and well, I kind of moved to see what it was, thinking that it was just the dog pulling on it. Just as I looked over my shoulder, I saw a dark shadow dart past me. My dog immediately jumped up to chase it, growling fiercely. I shot up too, and the dog ran to a closet door mirror at the foot of our steps. The dog was barking, growling, right at the mirror. I didn't see anything. She would not stop. She was up all night doing it. After that night, the dog wouldn't go anywhere near that mirror. I couldn't even drag her. One time I tried and she nipped me. She used to love going upstairs with my girls, but not anymore. I also had friends over often to my house playing pool in the basement. I didn't have a toilet down there at first, and one night, a buddy's girlfriend went upstairs to use the bathroom. She came running back down the basement stairs, white as a ghost. She wanted to leave, and she screamed, "Right now!" She said she saw a shadow, something at the top of the stairs, and she didn't want to talk about it, she just wanted to be gone. The house was built in 1890 near Calvary Cemetery, and I moved shortly after for other reasons, but I always wondered if others had issues there before me or after.
It's interesting. A lot of houses in Toledo, it's like they were built by a similar architect, because my great-grandmother's house was identical layout to the house my dad moved into like 10 years ago or something like that. I mean, exact same layout. My friend Nikki's house growing up, that Trisha and I talked about, exact same layout as these other two homes. And at the bottom was this closet door with a mirror on it. And so hearing Greg's story, I'm like, man, I wonder if this is the same like architectural house, because Nikki always claimed that there was something in that closet, that it was haunted. Same thing at my dad's. They were like, the little ones would always be like, don't go in that closet. And my great grandmother's house, we were always scared of that closet. And I'm like, I wonder if this, we're like, the architect, you know, was like, I'm gonna build this as a happy place for ghosts.
Well, so two things pop into my mind. One is, you know, your whole thing around the architect reminds me of Ghostbusters, because you know the main building. You know,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like a Ghostbusters architect type thing.
And then the second thing is the mirror piece, because you know we talked about it before. We've talked about it before about, you know, our mirrors portals, and the fact that there's a mirror on the door. So maybe it really didn't have anything to do with the fact that it was a closet in that specific, in that spot, but there was a mirror on the closet. The mirror was what made it accessible.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of older houses up north, you had two things that happened. Is you have one, you have like the alcove or the foyer or the breezeway. Because it gets so cold up there, you kind of, or a mud room as they would call it, but in the front of the house, and there would be places to hang your coats. Or if you didn't have one of those, or even if you did, the coat closet was right next to the front door, as a way to shake off any snow and things like that. So the fact that all these homes had this coat, because it was a coat closet, all the way across the living room to the steps, always seemed weird to me, you know, just an odd...
Yeah.
I guess it, you know, I guess that's where the stairs are, so it's just gonna be empty space. But
I mean, as far as houses looking somewhere, that's the case, I think, everywhere. Because unlike today, where there's thousands of different architectural plans that people can choose from, it used to be pretty much like, here's your five plans. You know, you want to build a ranch style house, a two story, a one and a half, whatever.
Well, and even then, a lot of times the cities would just build these neighborhoods, you know, back and then for affordable housing and things like that, especially in like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. A lot of them were cookie cutter, you know, you had like two or three designs and they would kind of shake it up a little bit, but for the most part, they were all pretty similar.
So. Yep. I mean, that's like a.
But yeah.
You know, just we're talking about Sarah's parents' house. Looks exactly like my friend Jason in his parents' house. So
yeah, it's so weird, man. But yeah, you know, thank you, Greg, for sending in that story. It's a good one. I think a lot of us that have had paranormal experiences have had those things. I know I've had blankets pulled and things like that. And yeah, when you have pets, you're like, God, you stupid dog. And then the dog's like, you stupid bark, bark, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, if you want to send in your listener story, please send that to us to fearscapepodcast@gmail.com. or at Fearscape Pod at any of our social media, or of course go to fearscapepodcast.com and submit a sighting, or just click on that send us a message, chat with us thingy majiggy, and you know, we want to hear those stories, even if it's just a couple quick lines. We collect them. I mean, this is just proof is in the pudding, and the more and more you guys send this stuff in, the more and more we're like, yep,
ghosts, yep, exactly,
are real. So and also for the new year, Josh, I know that you're still asking people for something. What is that?
You know, it'd be great if you would give us a nice review of the podcast wherever you can do it. We've named off a couple of places before. I think Spotify has it. Apple Podcasts, I know, does. But just any place that you can go out there, wherever you listen, check to see if they have a review option, and just drop us a good review. I mean, you know, I'm gonna be on. Drop us an honest review, but also, you know, we're always looking for 5 stars if we can.
I mean, we're
or
all
five
over.
Hearts
we're on,
or
we're on
whatever.
Pandora, iHeartRadio, we are on everything. So yeah, drop us that review. Also, make sure to check out our podcasts on our podcast network, Fearscape Media Network. You can just go to fearscapemedia.com, check that out. And then the other thing I wanted to quickly shout out before we get out of here is our brand new YouTube show with Santosh, Astral Stew. We just dropped our first episode here recently. Check that out. It's going to be a monthly series with us and Santosh and possibly some guests. It's just a lot of fun. Us just digging deep, man, into that astral stew.
Yep, just having some fun, talking about some really interesting topics. So.
Yep, well, kind of like, you know, McLaughlin group of the paranormal or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah. So check that out on YouTube. And other than that, Josh, we can get out of here, man. I'm going to go, you know, go pet my bark, bark. And my meow, meow.
Yeah.
When you say bark, bark and meow, meow, it sounds dirty.
Yeah, it does sound dirty. Yep. Sounds quakey, whatever you called me in the beginning. Yeah. What did you call me in the beginning?
Crusty.
Quirky. Crusty. Crusty. Sounds crusty. No? I don't know.
Post it's crusty. But anyways, yeah, we're going to get out of here. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. This has been Stefan, and I will catch you on the flip side.
This has been Josh. The truth is now.
Ooh. Damn. Like that. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
I'm so glad you were able to join us for that horrifying discussion. I hope they didn't frighten you too much. Tune in next week for even more research into the nightmarish and haunting creeps and spooks that we tell ourselves don't exist, but we know they do. Make sure you have your blankets, that you hold them extra tight. Next time on Fearscape.